History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it. And that's what we try to encourage you to do each week. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. In the process, we're educated, we're always entertained, and so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. There are a lot of World War II anniversaries we hear a lot about, but there are so many more that tend to fly under the radar. And 84 years ago this week marked the beginning of one of the more unique and certainly heroic elements of the Allied victory in World War II. The Cactus Air Force, a group of pilots operating under very challenging conditions off of a newly captured but frequently targeted airfield on Guadalcanal. When I say challenging conditions, I mean no food, no showers, no change of clothes, bouts with malaria and other tropical diseases, not to mention a formidable enemy attacking day and night. But those courageous men managed to inflict heavy damage on the enemy and go a long way toward ultimate victory in the Pacific. 6 Cactus Air Force pilots would end up being awarded the Medal of Honor. Nearly 100 Cactus Air Force pilots would make the ultimate sacrifice. And we're going to hear the memories from one who came close to that, but instead survived not just that Guadalcanal campaign, but the rest of the war, and lived to the age of 101. Before we're done, we're going to hear what his 2 Distinguished Flying Cross citations said he did, but we'll start in the early years for Nate Murphy, who lost both of his parents at a young age.
My family came from Nova Scotia. I don't know whether my mother and father became citizens or not. I had an uncle who I was living with, and he was an American, and he was a doctor. He treated us, my brother and I, it just was great, and we didn't feel that we were left out of anything. I mean, it was the way it was, and you lived with it.
And he was in Boston also, your uncle? Not to take a detour, but being a big baseball guy, I've got to ask you, if you went to Fenway Park.
Williams, Ted Williams.
Or even before that, did you get to go to Fenway Park as a youngster?
Yeah, well, but we weren't invited. If you stuck around, then maybe you might get in for the 8th or the 9th inning. It was pretty tight, actually.
I know that's a long time ago. But do you remember, as a boy, what your ambitions were? What you wanted to do when you grew up?
I didn't have any of it. When I got out of high school, I wanted to get a job doing something constructive. But the best I could do, I used to deliver the menus between the restaurant, Thompson's Spa, 4 of them in Boston. I think after about a year, I decided I needed to do something else. So I went down to the Air Force recruiter. I made an application to him. They said, no, you got to have 2 years or better of college before we'll even consider you. Now, this was before the war started, of course.
Right.
So I said, okay. And so I went to Northeastern University, and they put me in a program where I would study for 6 months, and then I would work for 6 months. And this went on for 2 years until I finally got my number required. I won't say they were all A's, but I won't say they were all F's either. But they're, shall we say they were closer to being an F. At that time, you could feel that there was a tension in the air, and I figured, doggone it, maybe they'll let me in. So I went around. They said no still. So then I went to the Navy, and they said, we'll take you. But if you don't pass, you don't go back to them. You go into the regular Navy and become a seaman second.
So what was it that first gave you that flying bug? What turned you on to aviation?
I went down to, my uncle took, for some reason, we were out, I guess somebody mentioned airplanes or something. But anyway, we went down to Squadron Mass, and that was a E-base, elimination base for the Navy. I watched them take off and land, take off and land. And you get airborne in these things, and you could look down through the floorboards of this thing, and you could see the ground and see the other airplane. So the day that the 6 months was up, I went down to Squadron, and they, okay, here it is. And they took me right then. Now I had a private pilot's license. Right. So, and they would let me get into the aerobatics. So I went up to Waterville, Maine. There was only about six or seven qualified guys at that time that they would let come in. And so I got into that.
What kind of planes were those you were flying?
N2S, N3N. Those were what took us all the way now down to Miami. And in Miami, you get to fly fighters, dive bombers. At that time, they had just relieved the fleet. They got F2Fs in the fleet. And so these planes were given to Miami. So now when you walked in the base and you walked up to the administration building, the runway was on the left and your planes would taxi on down and take off. And so I didn't have an automobile, so I was walking up carrying my suitcase watching these guys. And that was the first time I had seen anything like that. And this was fleet aircraft. They just taken them out of the fleet. That felt pretty damn good, but except I kept getting in trouble. I kept having dogfights with other guys and trying to see how high I could go on it. But anyway, I almost got canned out, but it was getting pretty hot, and so they excused me. So they said, okay, you put you on the base. You stay there for 60 days, and then we'll see what we're going to do with you. Well, I stayed for 60 days, and they said, okay, you're fine. Get back in. And then I got my orders to Scouting 71 on the WASP.
The USS WASP, the ill-fated USS WASP.
Yeah.
I've got a question for you before we get into all that. Where were you on December 7th, 1941?
I was at Norfolk, Virginia. The ship was in Bermuda operating anti-airplanes. And so I was waiting in Norfolk for her to come back so that I could join my squadron. We had an interesting experience there. One of the planes that they were making available for us to fly was a plane that was built by the Naval Aircraft Factory. It was one of the planes that they would give you time in. We were out one day checking things, and I was in the back seat, and we had a Lieutenant J.G. in the front seat. So consequently, he was fairly high-powered, and you know, you went along with him and kept your mouth shut and hoped you got through this thing. But anyway, just about the end of the period, he said, okay, let's shoot a couple of landings. And here's this little field down there. It looked like a postage stamp. And he said, okay. And so he readies himself for a landing. This airplane was sort of a one of a kind. It had a throttle that was very loose on the throttle. And when you wanted to come in to land or anything, if you just came back on it like that, the engine would go to idle, but not all the way to idle. So what would happen, of course, you'd come down and you'd want to land and you'd float a little. But up to that time, everybody could handle it well because they landed on the larger strips. But this day, he decided that he wanted to show me that he could land on one that small. And he pulled the throttle back, and I thought, well, when's he going to snap it? The engine was sitting there floating and going around. And he never did. So the thing hit on the runway. It was a dirt runway. And he pulled it back, and it didn't come back. He just kept pulling back, and he came down to the end of the runway, across the road, between two telephone poles, and coming right up on, looked like a chicken coop. He jammed, and I jammed on the foot brake. Well, of course, the thing hit in soft dirt. She comes up on her nose. Over she goes. My seatbelt broke and hit me right and knocked me out for a very, very short time. That was it. And a lady came busting out of the house, and she said, will you please be careful? My husband works nights. So,
well, with that story that you just told me, your career was almost over before it began.
It could have been, but I'll tell you. But after that, whenever I flew that airplane, I made sure that I could snap it back and make it stop.
Do you remember December 7th and how you found out what happened at Pearl?
Somebody yelled, we've been attacked. So immediately, whoever is in charge put a stop on, you can't go out, you can't come in. They just went ape. And they started closing down this like they wanted to have sentries, but they didn't have any guns because the guy with the tee to the Arsenal, he had him home with him. That was one of the idiotic things. And the other things, like you couldn't leave such an area because that was under guard and it wasn't under guard. But it was just a mess. So the ship came in during all this, took on all of us aviators, and out she goes again. So that was fine. So then we went out, and for about a week we were doing, I wasn't, because I was out. Tell you that story too. Well, we went out on anti-submarine, but we weren't qualified, so we just had to watch the big fellas doing it. But when we came in, they wouldn't let us get off the ship because the base was all marked down. What's it?
It was locked down.
Yeah.
On high alert.
Yeah. Consequently, we went out again, and that time we had to get at least 5 carrier landings before we could be used. So that's what the next thing to worry about. Oh, I had a funny one. Not funny, tragic, actually. The carrier loaded us. We had our own airplanes or on the beach now waiting, and so they hoisted them aboard. They didn't land them. They hoisted them aboard and shoved off. So when we went out of the harbor that afternoon, we put three planes up on anti-submarine to protect the carrier going out, which they did.
Flying over the carrier. Yeah. Looking for submarines that might threaten the Wasp.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
And so they sent out a Charlie to these 3 airplanes. Charlie, in those days, went land aboard, clear. They gave him a Charlie, and they came down and got into the landing pattern. And it was dark now. The lead one, he got aboard. He had no problem getting aboard. Because, see, nobody had any flight time or landings they qualified. But not at night.
Okay.
And consequently, now that the ship was in combat, they had to use them. So the first guy got aboard. The second guy did fine and came on down and gave a cut. And he hit in the deck and bounced and went over the side. And they never did recover him. And so while they're all running over, looking down the side, along comes Chuck Mester, who comes around, couldn't see anything, darker than hell. The flag lieutenant, the guy that waved him in,
right,
had no help. So he just came in and timed it and cut the throttle and landed aboard. So, and here I was standing up on the flybridge watching this. So believe me, I was not a carrier pilot at that time. It was all right. We went up to Casco Bay. We operated out of there for, a couple, 3 weeks, and they kept trying to get us qualified. And every time we'd get ready to go, weather would be bad or it's going to rain. Everything came up was wrong. So in order to get going, they had to hoist our airplanes onto barges.
Right.
And barge them out to the ship. And lift them aboard and shove off they were going to provide cover for a British convoy. They had to get me qualified. That's the name of the game. They thought, well, we'll do it while they're with the British people, while they're giving them protection.
Right.
So it was lousy weather. And it was cold. Oh, it was murder. So they put me in the airplane, and they said, shoot him off. I had all this stuff. I couldn't feel the gloves. I mean, everything was so cold and so bulky. I mean, no, you couldn't feel and get any, you just went, that's all. They said, give us submarine patrol for 3 hours and then come back aboard and you'll be qualified. Okay. So come the end of 3 hours, and they gave me a Charlie, and I came on down, and I was the only one in the pattern. I got in the landing pattern, and every time I come around, I would try to sink in with the flight deck. We had the LSO, landing signal officer, back there. He would track us around, and he'd get us about where he wanted us. And then just as we were about to give the cut, the deck would drop out. And all of a sudden, you got nothing. So you'd go on around again with an SP2U. Nobody ever told you anything about them.
Oh, I've heard
about
them.
Don't believe them. Don't believe them. But anyway, I think I made about 4 or 5 passes. And the old man said, land him. I didn't hear any of this, of course.
Right.
And I came on around, and everything looked good. And all of a sudden, down goes the gate. And he had already given me a cut power. So I cut the power, and I picked up an attitude. There's the deck, and there's me. And this is, I'm holding what I got. And so I float and float and float. And I mean, it was, I guess they must have floated 100 feet or more. Now it was, he said, okay, let's get back. So the carrier starts turning to get back into position so the destroyers could protect that area. And so he kept doing that, and all of a sudden he hits and stops. And I was that close to hitting it with a propeller.
Your propeller stopped inches away?
About that much. They had to push me back, and there was a 5-inch gun mount here. They had to push me clear of the 5-inch gun mount and push me back and get me back on the flight deck. So anyway, I am now a carrier pilot. We came from Norfolk to San Diego by train. While the other guys were coming around through the canal, they had all the old SB-2Us, so they were flying them then and providing sub-protection for the carrier. So by the time they got there, we were qualified in the SPD. Now we were ready to go. Didn't know where we were going. We shoved off, and we had a minimum of protection. I think we might have had 3 or 4 destroyers.
So you're leaving from San Diego, and you're going to the Pacific, where Midway has already happened.
Midway happened while we were underway.
Right.
But we never had any contact with them.
All right.
And as a matter of fact, we didn't know that was going on. I mean, it was not public. They took a beating, but they also gave a beating.
Well, and that was the key. And so many SBD pilots didn't come back from that battle. But the blow they dealt the Japanese was so severe. It was known as such a turning point. And so was the battle for Guadalcanal. But what you experienced at the start of that was not sunshine and roses. What can you tell me about your first day in combat flying off the Wasp toward Guadalcanal?
Well, we did bomb and strafe Guadalcanal and Tulagi.
Tulagi had the two little islands connected by a causeway in the harbor.
That's right, and that was our target.
Gavutu and Tanimbogo.
Tanimbogo, there you go, Tanimbogo.
Yeah. You bombed those islands?
That morning, we were given our target. Tanimbogo was our aiming point. We took off before daylight, darker than hell. I mean, I'd never flown that. And we had a 1,000-pound bomb. I'd never flown with a 1,000-pound bomb and didn't want to flow one, but what the hell can you do? So anyway, I was flying number 3 on the captain. Thank God for that. And I was nervous. I was nervous. I'd never done that before, and they wouldn't let us, of course, use lights. And all we had for landing was the exhaust. And if you flew up close enough underneath, you could see the exhaust coming out, and you flew on the exhaust. Well, that's fine. And then along comes another so-and-so, and he signs on me. And he's not supposed to be there, but there he is. What can I do? So I ignore him, and I pay attention to what the captain's doing, since he's going to get us to Guadalcanal. Well, that went fine until this jerk down here who decided that he wanted to see if his guns worked. So he did. He jammed his gun. Hey, that was good, too. I never knew before that with the SPD, it fired through the props. But anyway, he triggers off, and I saw it going by like that, and I thought, oh, boy, this is it. And I thought they were going to shoot us down. I couldn't talk. Couldn't tell me what he was doing. Yeah, just that one burst was all I saw. And so that gave me a little confidence the next morning that I know that really is nobody but our own. But it was the captain, I'm on his wing, and here's this guy down on my wing.
So did you drop that 1,000-pound bomb?
Yeah. And this is a picture of it. You don't want to see it.
Love to see it.
This one's Tanimbogo.
So you dropped the bomb that left Tanimbogo smoking like that?
Yeah.
That was the beginning of the Battle of Guadalcanal, a campaign that would continue for 6 months. 84 years later now, there is still an unknown number of unexploded bombs on that island. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, perhaps the most intense day of Cactus Air Force veteran Nate Murphy's time as a Navy pilot. It was a day that would mark the end of the carrier he'd been flying off of. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, drawing attention today to the Cactus Air Force, which came into existence 84 years ago this week on the island of Guadalcanal, where the newly captured but frequently contested Henderson Field was named for Major Lofton Henderson, who was the first Marine Corps aviator killed in the Battle of Midway 2 months earlier. Henderson Field is still there. Today it's known as Honiara International Airport. When Nate Murphy wasn't flying from Henderson, he was flying from the deck of the aircraft carrier USS Wasp, one of just two carriers, along with the USS Hornet, still operating in the Southwest Pacific at this point. On September 15, 1942, the Wasp was escorting reinforcements to Guadalcanal when three torpedoes from a Japanese submarine struck almost all at once. You can imagine what kind of chaotic catastrophe that created. 193 men were killed, 366 more wounded, 45 aircraft lost, but Nate Murphy's dive bomber had already been launched, along with 25 other aircraft. All but one of them would eventually land safely, but not on their carrier, because it was sunk.
That's right. We went off that morning on a 15-degree sectors. They sent out 12 SPDs to see if there was any Japs around.
Uh-huh.
Well, there wasn't any until we got back. And sure enough, there was, while we were gone, the Japanese had torpedoed the Wasp. And, of course, we had no way to go because we were too far out. We couldn't get to land. And we didn't have enough fuel to do anything. We had to either ditch the airplane or see if we couldn't land aboard. But nobody told us there was any room to land aboard. So we were in bad shape. My roommate, Bob Escher, he got low on fuel, and he had to land next to a cruiser. And when he did, of course, he had nothing but things in. He pushed his eyes back, and he couldn't. He never flew again. They picked him up, and that was it. So now we've got, I think, 12 SPDs. What are we going to do? Well, some smarty, thank God, from the Hornet said, come on over and land on the Hornet. And so I guess they put their heads together and can we do this thing? What they did, they launched six or eight of their own planes in a one-way shot at the closest island. That cleared the deck for enough airplanes so that we could land aboard the Hornet. So now we're pretty well filled up. So the next morning, the very first thing, they shot us off, all 12 of us, and that was it. So now we're on our own and heading for, well, we were hoping for one island. Of course, we couldn't. They won't talk to you, no radio. We had YEZB, where they every 15 degrees, they put a plane in there, and he searches 15 degrees, 15 degrees. And when they come back, now we've got the whole area cleared, and we're in pretty good shape. So they take the SPDs, and they shoot them off all together. They found a place called Espiritu Santos, and at Espiritu Santos, they rendezvoused, and they landed, and the Marines took us under cover.
So this YEZB was a top-secret system of radio homing signals to help guide you back to a carrier. There was a different Morse code letter assigned to each one of those 15-degree sections, and that changed daily to avoid the enemy figuring it all out. So that helped you in this situation where you couldn't communicate. But I want to go back and really understand what all this is like. And not to leave a loose end here, I know you later found out that the Hornet had actually shoved aircraft off the deck and into the ocean to make room for you, in essence, to save your lives. But tell me about this. You take off from your carrier, and you're out there patrolling for hours, right?
We got out 250 miles, uh-huh. out 250 over whatever that is and back.
Just looking for Japanese forces.
That's right.
Never saw anything.
Not that time. That's a routine search.
Right.
We used to do that at that time every morning and every night.
Now, and the whole point of this is to figure out where the enemy is.
That's right.
But they don't know how close the enemy is because these torpedoes hit the Wasp. So when you're flying back to your carrier, can you tell me what you saw when you were coming back toward the Wasp?
The only thing we could see at first was the black smoke, and you couldn't see anything down here. And the black smoke was coming, and as we got closer, then we saw the airplanes flying around, and we didn't join up. There'd be one here, one there, each looking for his buddy, you know, because you went in two plane searches. So we finally got organized. John Eldridge, our skipper, he got things going. He was a crackerjack. They got him organized, and then the Hornet broke in with a lamp telling us that what they were going to do. And so we then followed this one guy who picked us up and got to the Hornet, which now probably 50, 100 miles away. It had just taken off. They weren't going to get torpedoed.
Can you tell me, and I'm sorry for belaboring the point here, but what it felt like to see, and at this point, you don't know where the Hornet is. You're coming back to the Wasp. The only place you have to land is going up in smoke, and you've got a gunner in the back seat whose life you're also responsible for. What goes through your mind in a situation like that?
Actually, up until the time we decided to let us go with the Hornet, we were a little befuddled. Where are we going to go? No, I mean, you couldn't ask anybody. If you got close enough and you could get a lamp on it, you could do pretty good. But you couldn't do the radio. You couldn't do the whatever.
So you're on your own.
You're on your own until somebody took a hold of you and say, okay, come on, boys.
Well, I'm just trying to imagine myself in your shoes because you're 24 years old. You're halfway around the world from everything you know, and now your floating home on the ocean is burning, and you can't go back home. Did you think you were going to make it? Did you think you were going to die that day?
No, I don't have any, to my recollection. It was not good, but it was not. It could be solved. In other words, we had a great deal of respect for our Lieutenant Commander Eldridge, who was an older man. He was probably 32 or 33. Everything looked good. We ran a fuel check, and everybody's pretty good on fuel, except Bob Escher, who, if he hadn't been horsing around, he would have been with us. But every time Bob Escher got on a flight, he'd be making passes at people. And so when we get back from doing that, he didn't have the fuel. I didn't say anything. It was none of my business. He's my buddy.
I'm trying to think, and this has been your life. You've told this story for decades. But for the rest of us, it's kind of hard to understand or grasp. Have you ever thought about, what if the Hornet wasn't there?
No.
What would have happened to you?
No, that never.
The Wasp has been decimated. Were there people on the ship?
Oh, yeah.
That were killed, you knew?
Oh, yeah. The ones that I did know were friends, but I don't ever remember being greatly, maybe they might have been, but for some reason it didn't strike me as being an untenable situation. There it is. I think we got the answer and let it go. When we got back with the Hornet and got into Espiritu Santo, we didn't know what we were going to do. We had our airplanes, and we had 12 pilots, but nobody said, we're not going to do this to this to this. All of a sudden, we get a message, they need 3 planes. And so Eldridge, he just couldn't wait to get into combat. I'll tell you, we would say, take it easy. Maybe we'll go this way. So he did, and so the first contingent was 3 planes, and that lasted one day. Two of the pilots, they couldn't find him. They don't know what happened to him. And Eldridge is by himself now. So he said, send up 6 more. So they sent up 6 more. 650 miles one way. They couldn't go back, and they couldn't land until it was okay. So when we got there, it was just getting to be dusk. Now, we had a radio for just local use for landing them, you know, and stuff like that. So they told us to circle, that the field was under attack. You see the guys from the carriers once in a while come in, be in the nice press coveralls, you know, and they got the drink in their hand, and they turn us loose. When we come in, we had to land, and it would ping mud. I spent 7 weeks there. I had one bath in 7 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And couldn't shave, and everything was just yucky. It was terrible.
And I don't want you to sell this short, because, again, you lived it. The rest of us didn't. But you take off from Espirito Santo, 650 miles. To Guadalcanal. There's no going back.
That's right.
It's a one-way deal. You only have enough fuel to get there. And as you're coming in, you hear the field that you're supposed to land on is under attack. So what are you supposed to do?
Circle, like they said.
Until when? You run out of gas?
You don't know. They're the boss now. So you just have to take your chances and hope. We did as we felt we should do or could do. That was our ball game. That's our field, the flying. The next morning, we were off early in the morning before it was almost daylight, six of us. We scouted out in the direction of which they had coming down from Rabaul, which was the big base.
For Japan, right.
Yeah, they came down on that run. So you'd run on down, do a little strafing, and if you got any bombs at all, drop your bombs and go on home. Most of the time, that was pretty quiet, but they could get a little sticky. I mean, we lost a couple there.
So most of these missions, you're flying off with bombs. Are you looking for ships to drop them on?
That's true.
Uh-huh.
That's true. We usually used to carry 500 with 125, I think, on the outside under the wings. You dropped what you thought you needed.
And this is basic stuff for you, but for the rest of us, maybe you can help us understand. When you make a dive bombing run on a Japanese ship, can you take us through that process start to finish? What you're doing and how it works?
We had a pretty good idea of where it is because we knew we'd hurt them. We'd hurt them on that first strike. The next morning, we were hot to trot. We wanted out. We wanted to go get it. And, of course, when we got there, they found out that Eldridge's plane is already gone. They couldn't have gotten that far away that we wouldn't have found them. So then we looked around and we found the second flight of three. We figured we must have gotten three close hits to roll them over, or else they would be there waiting for us.
So these are groups of Japanese ships that were going to land troops on Guadalcanal? Is that what those were?
Yeah, troops and supplies.
So when you make that run, though, in an SBD, can you tell me what you have to do to dive down, how you release your bomb, what that feels like, what you're seeing through that process?
Oh, anything else now that you'd like? I mean,
I'm checking off the menu like you used to deliver.
Yeah.
Well, no, because most of us have never done that.
Well, that's true. And I had only done one or two myself. As a matter of fact, that was the first time I really dropped a good shot at something. Here's two Japanese destroyers. We're hot to trot. We want to get a shot at him. So we make a pass. The SPDs do not go at him. The SPDs come over here, and we follow. And we know we're looking. We got wind to worry about. We got sun to worry about. But anyway, we're coming up on him, and we're not going to let him shoot at us all the way in. I mean, why give him a free shot? So you come along here and you get ready, and then you start peeling it off.
You're now gradually peeling down toward the
that's
ship.
That's right. You start it on down. Your main interest is dropping on him.
And how close to that ship do you get before you release your bomb?
We have the rear seat gunner every 500.
He calls it out.
Calls it out, yeah. Then you drop and come out. Then you have to be aware. The first one I ever went on was these two destroyers, and I pulled out. Nice, easy pull out. Nothing ahead of us. We're going great. And then some, hey, Mr. Murphy, what's the trouble? Look behind you. And I look behind, and cripes, they must have thrown the whole damn ship at us. They were just, you know, going in like crazy. I forget that you're not out of it until you're well clear. Don't go horsing around.
So even though you've released your bomb and you're climbing back away from that, you've got anti-aircraft fire coming your way.
Yeah, that's right.
When you looked around, that's all you saw.
That's right.
And what about physically What does that feel like when you dive in and then pull back out? What does that do to your body?
I think we're young enough it didn't bother us at all.
Yeah, you don't gray out or anything?
Well, no, you're not supposed to gray out. You're supposed to, that's why they call off the time.
Uh-huh.
Maybe because we, once in a while, don't split the flaps. We might do a little bit, but really that there was never... Oh, one time on a Rabal, we had quite a strike. And anyway, as we pulled out, the cloud cover moved in. So as I came down, I had to go through a cloud, which was fine. And I continued the dive until when I pulled out. When I pulled out, and I almost went into the water. I almost went into the water, but I lucked out. So when I did, I kicked my right rudder and tried to throw the bomb into the destroyer.
You tried to basically throw it sideways because you're so low altitude.
Yeah.
Wow. And then if it detonates too soon, you're not far enough away yet. You could blow yourself up in a move like that.
Well, you know, I got to thinking about that afterwards. why did you do that? You don't know. Because the damn thing had things that fit in there like that.
Right.
And if you flew the normal, it would go this way. But if you didn't do that, it gets that way and it sticks.
Then so, it's hung on you and you got to shake it loose.
And so lucky, lucky, lucky.
Well, and I guess that's my question about this in general on these missions. How small is your margin for error?
Pretty, pretty small.
If you're a split second too late, you and your gunner are both dead.
Could be, yeah. It's stupid, actually, but you really want to get a hit. You just love to get a hit. Sometimes you get it, sometimes you don't.
It's time for our final break, but when we come back, we'll read Nate's Distinguished Flying Cross citations. We're remembering the Cactus Air Force 84 years after its ragtag beginnings on the island of Guadalcanal. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing on the Cactus Air Force today, which 84 years ago this week at Henderson Field was just beginning. Reading about the Medals of Honor, the Gold Star Heroes, or even the time a couple months later when the Japanese waged a failed four-day effort to recapture Henderson Field, that all tells a story, but there's never anything better than hearing from the men who flew those missions. And in Nate Murphy's case, that was a pretty high number of missions.
Just about 50, yeah.
How often did you get shot up by their guns?
Actually, in all the bar over there, I only got hit once. And it put a hole in my wing like that and caught on fire, and the gas came out and caught on fire, and I push over and a little more, until finally the flames separated from the gas. And as I went faster and faster, it went up my arm like so, and then it broke off and I peeled away and got away with it. But to this day, I can't tell you what happened. Where did the rest of the buzz go? I look and I'm all alone.
I've got to stop you here and ask you more about this, because you realize you're talking about this like it's no big deal. But this is your life at stake. You just got a hole blown in your wing and your wing's on fire. How did you know to go into a dive and pick up speed to try to extinguish that? Had you practiced that? Had you been taught that?
I don't know. I had never been hit before. Didn't seem to bother me. I was lucky enough so that it caught on fire real early, so I had plenty of room, plenty of altitude. We were coming in at something like 25,000, I think.
Did you know there was ACAC incoming, or did it just... You just felt it.
At that time, we had pretty much put Rabaul out of the game. We ran a strike on Rabaul every single day. In our part, we'd do it every third day. But somebody made a strike every day, and they would shoot at us every single day.
But so on this occasion, you're kind of caught off guard when all of a sudden you get hit.
I was riding on the number two position. We were coming in, and I got interested in they were dropping bombs by coming down and going like that and throwing the bomb into our advanced planes. So while they were doing that, I was watching because I could see three fighters, the twin boom.
P-38.
P-38, yeah. Uh-huh. And so I was watching that, and as I was watching, I saw a plane, and he was up in the air, 25,000. And he came, and I watched him come across. So I told Panos to keep an eye on that guy because he could give you trouble. And so he drifted back until he went out of sight. So then I didn't see anything. And so I just stayed where I was and kept on going, and then all of a sudden, boom, and here's that hole. Funniest thing in the world.
So it was from a Japanese plane above you, mm-hmm. that the hole came? So
yeah.
they snuck in behind you, put a hole in your wing, and you say, okay, I'll go into a dive and extinguish this flame.
I started off this way, and then I converted to this way as they found out that it wasn't doing the trick. I went a little faster until I got fast enough to blow it out. So,
were you scared?
No, I wasn't scared. That I can remember. I probably was.
It strikes me as a real high-speed aerial game of chicken. Yeah, you're going faster and faster towards the surface, which you can't go past that, so you're running out of time. And if this thing keeps burning, you don't have a plane to fly.
Well, that's true.
And you made it back all right.
Yeah, but as I was saying, I can't tell you one way how that plane got back. I thought I lost a lot of fuel, but evidently I didn't.
When you bring a plane like that in, do you go out and take a look at that wing after you're on the ground?
Oh, I suppose I did. Yeah, I suppose so. Man, I don't know if I had a picture of that. I don't think we did.
You think you could fit your head through that hole?
No, it wasn't that big.
Not quite. Put your arm through it.
Yeah.
And as far as life in the Cactus Air Force, you kind of made reference to this earlier. So you're flying these missions all the time, but your living conditions on Guadalcanal were probably pretty poor.
All I know, that like the first night that we landed there, I think there were four Marines. And they were going home the next day, and they were riding so-so, and their heads and shoulders were sticking out above the ground. The Japanese were shelling the field at the time. What happened was they got shrapnel, and it decapitated them. That's the first night. After that, we learned to keep your head down underneath and don't get in trouble.
Because they had ships that would pull up and shell Henderson Field, round after round after round.
They were big guns.
So you're there at Henderson Field. What are you going
to
do?
Well, what happened to me, I was in sick bay. I had 104 fever, yeah. So when I heard the first gun go off, I decided I could find better places. So I got into the foxhole. Now, I don't know who was in there with me. All I know is I got into the thing, and I just stayed there.
So you're sick as a dog. You're 104 fever, and you're hiding in a hole while shell after shell after shell comes in.
It was not the way to go, believe me.
How long does that last?
Well, I'd say it lasted at least 2 hours.
What goes through your mind?
Frankly, I don't know. I was sitting there. I was sitting like so.
You're shaking.
And I was shaking. And I really wasn't worried too much about what other people thought at that point. I just wanted out myself.
Yeah. And malaria was kind of a reality of everybody who ended up there. Malaria, dysentery.
Yeah, you get all the diseases that you want. Well, I only, to my knowledge, got malaria.
Which is pretty bad.
Well, I guess so. I remember I used to catch it at home once in a while.
After you came back?
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of guys did.
And so.
When you have to go fly a mission, battling malaria, and you're operating this big airplane that you've got to dive around and maneuver. I mean, is that hard?
Never seemed to occur to them that there was any problem. I got picked up one night to go with my buddy Pete Coit. We started on out, and we were going for the main runway. I ran into a shell hole. I just couldn't get it out. Every time I'd ease the throttle, the back end would come up, and if I got any more, it would have caught the propeller. So I was just stuck. At that time, the shells were landing on the main strip. So you taxi on down, and here's the shells shooting here. And here you and come down. Okay, this is it. And you turn in here, and here the guy keeps shooting, and you're coming in, and then you take off. Once in a while, one of the guys would not go down far enough, and they'd hit the coconut trees at the end of the runway.
Well, yeah, and you've described a lot of the different hazards that you had to face, the different things that could have hurt you or killed you. So to be over there that long, to fly all those missions with shells from battleship and machine guns from ground forces and everything else that could get you, do you ever marvel at the fact that you survived it all?
No, I just remember on November the 3rd, there was a DC-2 or a 3 lighted aboard, and they took off, and our next stop was 602 miles.
That's how you left Guadalcanal?
Yeah.
And that felt good?
Yeah. I never apologized for it. There were things I could have done, probably should have done. I'm alive. I'm not dead. That was the name of the game.
No pressure. How do you feel about me reading your citations?
Oh, I don't care. I don't care if you read it.
The President of the United States takes pleasure in presenting the Distinguished Flying Cross to Lieutenant Harold N. Murphy, United States Naval Reserve, for heroism and extraordinary achievement as a dive bomber pilot attached to Scouting Squadron 71 in action against enemy Japanese forces in the Solomon Islands area from September 28th to November 5th, 1942. Participating in numerous vital bombing raids on enemy surface vessels, Lieutenant Junior Grade Murphy pressed home his attacks with fierce aggressiveness and expert airmanship, scoring 3 direct hits and probably 2 others on hostile destroyers. On October 15th, when an enemy invasion fleet of 5 transports and 8 destroyers was sighted in the immediate vicinity of Guadalcanal, he assisted in sinking 4 and possibly 5 of the transports, despite severe fighter opposition and anti-aircraft fire. By his dauntless fighting spirit and unswerving devotion to duty throughout these engagements, Lieutenant Junior Grade Murphy contributed in large measure to the success of our forces in repulsing determined enemy attacks on Guadalcanal. Signed, for the President, Frank Knox, Secretary of the Navy. That sounds like pretty big stuff, Nate.
Do you believe that?
You tell me. You lived it. I didn't. It says you guys sank 4 and possibly 5 of those transports despite severe fighter opposition and anti-aircraft fire. So they're shooting at you from the air and the ground, and you still got your job done and blew up those ships.
Do you believe it?
Yeah.
I cannot believe one person can do this and live to tell about it.
Well, let me throw some more at you then, because that was 1942. This is later on, because you weren't done after Guadalcanal. So they gave you a gold star in lieu of a second Distinguished Flying Cross.
Wait a minute now. Where do we stand here?
You got the DFC for that, what I read you. So here's the second one. For heroism and extraordinary achievement in aerial flight as division leader and pilot of a bomber in Bombing Squadron 98 during operations against enemy Japanese forces in the Solomon Islands and the Bismarck Archipelago from October 29, 1943, to May 15, 1944, completing numerous bombing and strafing attacks on Japanese shipping, shore installations, airfields, and supply areas during this period, Lieutenant Commander, then Lieutenant Murphy, scored damaging hits on a gun position at an airfield in Bougainville, a large cargo vessel, and another gun position near Simpson Harbor at Rabaul, and destroyed 2 gun positions near the runway of the strongly defended bomber strip at Vunakanau, Rabaul. His skilled airmanship and courageous devotion to duty in the face of intense anti-aircraft fire and intercepting enemy fighter planes were in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service.
High praise for Nate Murphy, whose memories gave a taste today of what it was really like to engage the Japanese as part of the Cactus Air Force all those years ago. Usually the Marine Corps pilots get most of the credit, but those Navy dive bombers did quite a bit of damage too, and they had to deal with the same primitive conditions on Guadalcanal. Their courage and their results remain the stuff of legend all these years later. Nate Murphy was originally from Boston, Massachusetts, but he spent most of his life in Southern California. After the Navy, he earned an engineering degree from San Diego State at age 47, and he enjoyed calling Coronado home until his passing at 101. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.